Hi, everybody. I'm Meg. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Meg.
I'd like to start with a prayer, if that's all right with all of you. God, help me to set aside everything I think I know. Help me to be humble so that you will be here, that I won't be full of self, that you will be here, and that people will see you. That they will have an experience of the God of their understanding, and that we will all know the truth and be continually set free to love you and serve you and each other. Amen. So I wanted to share with you, I was just thinking about this a couple of years ago. I had an experience. Oh, I should say, my sobriety date is November 4th, 2001. So God willing, and the creek don't rise, I'll have, what, 24 years? November 4th, which is a miracle. It's just a miracle. And a couple of years ago, I had a very emotional experience where I was in a place of worship, and I was doing my best to have my conscious contact with the God of my understanding. And I'm 65 years old. And so as an older woman, I've lived a lot of life. And a lot of that was a drunk life. And a lot of that drunk life was creating misery of my own making, was creating misery and suffering for the people who loved me and cared about me. Was wrecking things, you know, creating chaos. And I'll get into that in a minute. But I had this experience where it was like these moments in my life crystallized in front of in my mind's eye. And it was as though God were showing me that he was there with me in that devastation that I had created. Year after year after year, the God of my understanding was there in the mess with me, orchestrating things, waiting for the right moment when I would surrender enough for him to be able to intervene and save me. I mean, save my life. And it was just so big for me because I think I spent a lot of my life drunk and sober trying to earn God's approval. And it's something that has had deep roots in my soul. And so I know better, but it's in there, you know. And after at 20, almost 24 years, God is starting to uproot that. There's an old story, and it's about a farmer who had his servants plant crops. And when they planted them, some weeds grew up with the crops. And his servants came to him and said, "Should we pull the weeds?" And he said, "Not yet, because the crop's not strong enough. Wait until it matures, and then it will be able to withstand pulling out the weeds." And that's what my experience has been with a lot of my character defects. You know, the ones that are really deep rooted in me. God has been so patient with me to love me and to accept me and to give me love in my life through my sponsor, my sponsees, so that I get to experience this now and not yet. And it's not a not yet like, ooh, the yets will happen if I drink again. It's a not yet of the joy that awaits me with every day, every month, every year that I stay sober. As someone who is a very late bloomer and a very slow growing person, it's really true. I mean, it's just taken a long time for things that I see, sponsees, other people in the program get quickly. I was so slow and still am. But I think that part of the purpose of that is so that I could learn God's grace and God's patience. Because if it had happened faster for me, I think I would have rested on my own laurels. I would have chalked it up to doing something out of my own self out of my own ego. And I can safely say that I don't have any claim to my ability to stand up in front of you and give you what is my experience, strength, and hope. God has done all of it for me. I was born with an alcoholic mind. I believe that utterly. And what I mean by that is I was a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. I wanted desperately to be good and to be loved. But in doing that, I would give you what I thought you wanted, and I would resent you. I would resent you for demanding so much of me, for having expectations of me. And they were all expectations that I imposed on you, that I assumed of you. So I was in this crazy kind of private Idaho in my brain, you know. I remember at a very young age hating my parents. I mean, literally hating them. But again, I wanted to be good. I didn't want to be a hateful person. So what I did was the Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde thing. I hid the bad and showed the good to the best of my human ability. And that worked to some extent. It had to, because it got me through until I could medicate myself in some way. I started, to be honest, with food, using food as an escape. But by the time I was a teenager, it became alcohol. And that worked so much better because it literally took me out of my skin. And it was in my skin that I was most uncomfortable because of that civil war going on in the inside, you know, the part that wanted to be good and the part that was capable of hatred. And I lived like that for a long time after I discovered alcohol. And I drank as much for how I perceived you saw me as for how I felt, because I was more comfortable inebriated with the edge off. I felt more open to some acceptance and some an attitude of kindness from you. I could receive it. And that's something that I didn't discover until I got sober, is that when I did my amends, for instance, I discovered that people really cared about me. And I didn't know. I didn't know. I assumed when I was drinking that I didn't matter. You know, and I would disappear from people's lives because you don't care. You know, I had that attitude, and it was a genuine delusion on my part. And it's part of my alcoholic insanity. When I started drinking, I couldn't get enough from the very beginning. And I couldn't drink every day because I was still a teenager. But when I went off to college, I did. I drank every day, and I was a blackout drinker every day. And I don't know about you guys. I don't know how we survived that stuff. How do we go? Because I was like 20 years old, and I didn't get sober until I was in my 40s, my early 40s. How do we do that? How do you go to school and get a degree and get a job and start work? How do you do that? There's a story. I love this scene out of Monty Python, if you've ever seen the original Monty Python. I can't remember it exactly, but there's a knight and he's fighting some opponent, and the opponent lops off his arm and he says, "It's only a flesh wound," you know, and he lops off his leg and then another leg until he's finally this bloody stump and he's still trying to fight. That's how I was as an alcoholic. That's exactly how I was, you know, full of fear. But when bad things would happen, I would just say, "Oh, it's only a flesh wound. Oh, I crossed that police crossing. Oh, you know, my principal didn't see that I was drunk or that I was smelled like alcohol." Gosh, a lot of my 20s and 30s are a blur, to tell you the truth. There were periods of sobriety, periods of time, and they were much like what Bill W. described when he went to the cathedral and he had that experience of God, just for a moment. My older brother died when I was 27, and I went for about maybe 5 months, 4 months without drinking. And during that time, let me just tell you, I always believed in God. I always wanted God in my life. I did. I really wanted him. And the beauty of AA was that AA gave me a way to be in relationship with him that I didn't have. I was lacking that. And I could go to church all I wanted to, and I wasn't able to access that. And some of that was my own alcoholic thinking. I always felt other than. I never felt part of. And so I would see people at church and they were like shiny, happy people. And I knew that I was not one of those people because somewhere in me, I knew I was capable of hatred. And so I became a person who tried to live up to something that I knew in my heart I couldn't live up to. And it felt like walking a tightrope with a gun to my head. And alcohol was the thing that made me take a breath until it started giving me problems. And then it was like, it's only a flesh wound. You know, I would rationalize those problems away. Let me see. So there were lots of blurry times in my 20s and 30s. And like the big book says, even though I could go for a number of months without drinking, I always found a trivial excuse to go back to the booze. Even when I experienced in my 30s, I would go home and visit my mother and my stepfather on a weekend, say, and I wouldn't drink for the weekend because they had a problem with it. And I would feel so much better. I would actually sleep. I would actually feel like a person. And I would come back to my house, and the first thing I would need to do was drink as much as I could, as fast as I could, even though I knew that it made me feel bad, even though I knew that I would hurt myself. I was an alcoholic who fell. Like in the middle of the night, I would get up and I would still be hungover or drunk or whatever. And I would get this happened at least once. I got my foot caught in the sheet and I sprained my ankle trying to get out of bed. You know, and I would go to school. I was a teacher. I would go to school on crutches, and the children would say, "Miss Hart, did you have a skiing accident?" And I go, and I actually couldn't get out of bed. I dislocated my pelvis falling down the basement steps. I mean, this is the stuff I would do all the time. So let me think for a second where I am. That trivial excuse to take a drink, no matter how much better I felt when I didn't drink, I couldn't leave it alone. I was incapable of leaving it alone. And I can tell you that long after it stopped working to provide any sense of ease and comfort, I still needed to drink. I think part of that was the physical allergy, but a lot of it was just the mental obsession with drinking. And the mental obsession was locked on this promise of yesteryear. Maybe this time I will feel that, and I wouldn't. And in the end, I didn't even feel drunk. I mean, I remember in the end, sitting on my balcony, smoking and drinking and feeling stone cold sober, and I'd get up and fall over and hurt myself. You know, I set fire to the carpet once. This is a funny story. I ordered over $3,000 worth of magazines. This was back when phones were still plugged into a wall. And I got the credit card statement. I'm like, this cannot be. And I called them. You know how the phone number is on your credit card statement? I called and I said, I did not order these magazines. And the guy said, would you like to hear the tape? And they played me back drunk out of my mind. I ordered Guns and Gear, pro wrestling, Field and Stream, some automotive ones. I mean, all kinds of magazines. And I got those magazines the first, I think, maybe 10 years of my sobriety. I was still getting them, but they would be full in my mailbox every day when I got home. You know the beauty of that? God was just chuckling saying, Meg, you're an alcohol. Because every time I would open that up, I'd be like, yep, I'm an alcoholic. My sponsor at the time, she was, Sammy is my third sponsor. I had one my first year, one my second year, and then I got Sammy, and we are together forever. We're a lifelong commitment, she and I. I love her so much. She is responsible for me standing here. She gave me new life. I did the best I could the first couple of years, but my sponsors, the ones before Sammy, were not grounded and rooted in the big book, and that's what I needed. So I'll get to that later. What did I want to tell you about that? Shoot. Oh, my second sponsor, she tells this great story where when she got sober, she would drive in her car and she'd say out loud, yes, I'm an alcoholic driving down 64. Yes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to go park now. Yes, I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to pick up my mac and cheese. She did that like for several months. So I love that. We're so, I mean, I love alcoholics. I love, one of the things I love about AA is that we all have been there. I don't think you can go anywhere else where every single person in the room has been where you've been. We may have different stories, but we've got the same, we've suffered, you know, we've done bad things that we have shame and guilt about, you know, or have had. We've had to pick up a spiritual toolkit. And not only that, we've had to support each other in picking it up. And that's so huge. That's so huge. I've never found it anywhere else. So going back, I became a teacher and I, was a good teacher and a bad teacher because I was a drunk. And at this point, I was in my 30s. I got sober at 41. I think I turned 42 in treatment. So the last 10 years of my drinking looked like Groundhog Day. I would come home. Well, I'd start the day off hungover, feeling like death. And I would I would throw clothes on and rush to the car with coffee. And while I'm driving down the interstate with one hand, I'd be putting on my makeup in the rearview mirror and badly. And I would get to work and I loved my kids. I loved teaching. Maybe around 11 o'clock, I would start to feel like a person again. But then maybe around 11:30 or 12, I would start getting restless, irritable, and discontent again. And I would have in the morning promised myself, also known as promising God, desperately wanting what the jaywalker tried to do. He tried every known means to get that idea out of his head. I was fighting with the phantoms in my brain. I didn't realize that till after I got sober. When I saw that, what I was asking God for was for the thought not to cross my mind. Because the minute I did, it did. I was completely hopeless and helpless. I was a puppet on a string, and I knew it. I knew it. I knew I could put it off for a few hours, maybe, but that eventually I would drink. I knew that about myself. I didn't know that it was just the obsession. It's the mental part of our disease. I didn't know that. I thought it was me being crazy. I did. But I was just like that. So I would promise myself or ask God, and then I would start to feel better, and then I would get restless, irritable, and discontent. And all this while I'm working, I'm teaching classes, I'm doing things. And by 3:30 or 4, whenever it is that I would be able to leave, I could not get to the 7-Eleven fast enough. I couldn't get there fast enough. It wasn't even, the possibility of not drinking wasn't even on the table anymore, you know, because I had to have that promise of ease and comfort. And this is long after it really worked for me. And I would stop at a 7-Eleven because I had to drive 50 minutes on the highway to get home. And I would drink from a big gulp cup all the way home. And there I would go, well, no, halfway home in Bottoms Bridge, I would stop off at a Food Lion and I get my signature box of wine. Because at that point, that's what I drank because it was cheap enough. And I would drink the whole box, which was supposed to be 9 bottles. And I would drink that until, I mean, I don't think it's really 9 bottles, but that's what they say on the cover. But I would drink just about the whole thing until I blacked out. And then the next morning we would start over again. And that went on for years and years and years. Little did I know that my principal was concerned about me because he, newsflash, he actually cared about me. I was more than an employee. I was a human being in his eyes because he's a good person. I didn't know there were good people like that out there. So one day he called me into his office and he confronted me. Now, I had had people ask me questions before. I used to coach track. This was back before they had all the electronic stuff. And I would be the, what is that called? The clerk of the course. I would have to take down the times of the runners. And the guy who shot the gun at the beginning, He had been a colonel, and he one day standing, this is what happened to me all the time. He's standing beside me, like this far away from me, and he turns to me and he says, "You know," out of the blue, he says, "I had to fire someone for drinking." "It's only a flesh wound." You know, I'm like, oh, you know, I was always in fear. You know, I couldn't admit to myself that people knew, but they did know. I had been, I got this honor and I thought, I'm going to take this honor and I'm going to run away from the school system and I'm going to get a new job and start over again where I'm not going to drink the way that I've drunk, right? Well, I couldn't get a job. So they hired me back as an assistant principal.
Oh,
Right. And I'm working for the man, Mark, who was the principal. He's now the principal, right? I'm his assistant. This is before I got sober, so I wasn't teaching when I got sober. But all this time, he's watching me, and he knows something's really wrong. And it turns out later, I discover that the head of the lower school, who was my mentor when I first started teaching, and the school system nurse, and he had sat down multiple times, and they had said, "What are we going to do about Meg? What are we going to do about Meg?" And I just am so grateful because he was not an alcoholic, and yet he did exactly what the employer talks about doing. He sent me to his doctor, who called Mark and said, "She's too sick to get sober on her own. Medically, she's unstable. We need to send her to treatment." I had to apply to treatment centers. I was turned down left and right because my insurance wouldn't cover it because I was too much of a liability. And I finally got somebody to answer who would take a credit card for me for a week-long intensive. I get down there, they say, "You're too sick to go home." I'm like, "Tell me about it." So that's how I got sober. Mark confronted me, and I can't tell you why I was honest with him. I can't tell you why that was different. I had gone to doctors for my drinking. I had gone to a doctor and said, "I'm worried about my drinking." He said, "How much are you drinking?" And I lied. Shame and guilt, you know, hiding. The big book talks about how we don't give psychiatrists a fair chance because we're not honest with them about what we're doing. And I get that. Honesty is a big part of my recovery, and it's taken a long time to get really, really honest. Really honest. I could be honest about the big, huge stuff, but I would lie about stupid stuff. My mother would call me and ask me what I was doing. I would lie to her. What is that about? You know, it's just a way of life that needs to be turned around, that needs to be cleaned up so that I can have hold my head up and have some integrity. So everybody, it turned out, thought that I had cancer. The kids, the parents, the other teachers. But Mark wrote down, everybody wanted to send me stuff, and he wrote down my address. And the place I was staying was called Shades of Hope. And so everybody knew in this small town school, everybody knew, but they already did. They already did. Mark had been meeting with other people already. So I, by the grace of God, got to keep my job, got to go away to treatment, got to come back to Richmond and pour myself into AA. Spent 42 days, 42 days. 6 weeks in treatment, and it was hard. It was hard, but I was separated from the drink, right? And my insurance wouldn't cover anything, so I owed, I think it was $25,000. And at the end of my stay, they said, "You got to take out a loan." Well, at that time, 2001, interest on loans was like over 20%. And I, this is again, God did for me what I couldn't do for myself. I said, "I'm not doing that." They said, "You have to." I said, "No, I don't. I haven't signed anything." I said, "I'll pay you X $100 a month until it's paid off." They said, "You can't do, nobody's ever done that before." And I said, "You watch me." And I did it. I did it. And it was a way that God helped me hold my head up. You know, when I was first getting sober, I was doing something right. I was doing, and God provided for that, right? So I threw myself into AA. I want, okay, this is defective, Meg. I wanted my spiritual experience. because I wanted to be Mother Teresa. I thought that if I worked hard enough at the steps that I would become this beacon of spirituality. That's what I wanted, that with all my heart. I thought that would distinguish me and make me particularly lovable to God. I had all these old ideas about God, old ideas. My sponsor had me write down all my doubts and prejudices when we did step two. And I still remember you saying this. I wrote down things like my doubts and prejudices were God is kind of tired of me. He is condescending to be kind, but he's really, you know, there's a deep sigh and an eye roll behind that. I have to live up. And Sammy said to me, Meg, that's you. You're worshiping a mini Meg. Your idea of God is self. And it took me several years to get that. And I remember, because I learned in treatment, the third step prayer, the seventh step prayer, we prayed them every day, relieve me of the bondage of self. And I had this picture suddenly of me wrapped up in self like this. What do I see? If I try to look at you, all I see is myself, because I'm wrapped up around myself. And the reason that we learn how to give from early on is because we don't have to think about self when we give. We get relief from it. We get relief. One of my first meetings, Nancy, this woman said to me something, obviously I've never forgotten. She said, the steps will do for you permanently, day by day, and authentically, what a drink once did for you, falsely and temporarily. And I hung on to that. I hung on to that because at that point, the only thing that I really knew was that I had been in hell and I didn't want to live there anymore. I didn't know what it would be like to be free because I was still all bound up in so many character defects. What time is it? Six. Oh, I got time. So my first time through with the steps, oh my goodness, I'll just share with you. I read those fourth step promises and just, that was not my experience. I did not feel like I was walking hand in hand with the spirit of the universe. I just felt bad because I still wanted to be somebody I wasn't. And when I shared with my sponsor at the time who I had been, I saw that through the filter of the belief that I was maybe bad, but other people were worse, and that I was a victim, that I had been wronged, and that I was just trying to survive and do. I still had all this delusional thinking. And here's the thing, I didn't bring God into it because I was still so self-reliant. And the fourth and the fifth step talk a lot about prayer. But I kind of glossed over that. And it's one of the reasons that I think that I had a real hard time my first time through. God kept me sober. God kept me sober. And even after that fifth step, when I just felt not good, we have things we can do. I went straight to my meeting. I had a service position. I was an assistant to the assistant coffee maker when I was first getting sober. And I remember sitting on the curb with him after we had made coffee and set up, and just telling him I felt awful. And he told me about one time when he had felt awful. And I got that connection, that sense of not being alone. And so God was able to meet me there, even though I had all these weeds in my crops, you know, all this stuff that was still, I was so convoluted. I'm just going to skip. I had a big moment in my first ninth step. I had wronged this woman horribly and had twisted the tale in my own mind so that I was the victim. And I believed it. I was delusional in that way. And it had been 20 years before. So there had been a long, long time before. I'd actually, her husband and I were intimate. And I actually lived with him for a period of time. And I had made her into this villain, but I had destroyed her marriage, basically. She wasn't even on my fourth and my fifth step, and she wasn't on my eighth step list, but God used my character defect. I wanted my spiritual experience. So I said to my sponsor, I want so badly to make sure that I'm thorough. And she said, no worries at all. Before you go to sleep, just get on your knees and ask God if there's anything that belongs on that eighth step that you haven't put on there, just to give it to you. And I did that. And I woke up the next morning with her name. Still didn't know the truth, but I added her to the list. We got to the ninth step. I didn't know how to reach her. It had been 20 years. The early 2000s. So the internet was not like it is today. But I had to make amends to her husband, her ex-husband. And when I made amends to him, he was able to tell me, give me some clues about how to reach her. She sold daylilies on the internet. And I found her and I emailed her. And she emailed me back and said, "What the bleep do you want?" And everything in me wanted to run away. Everything in me. But I heard God speak inside here. And he said, "Okay, we're going to do it here." And so I told her what I knew to tell her at the time. "I wronged you. I harmed you. And I need to take responsibility for it and make amends." She said, this went on for a couple of months, back and forth, back and forth. She said, "Oh, you want to know what it was like for me? Everything in me wanted to run away. I didn't want to face that. But God was speaking to me. And he said, that's your amends." And so I wrote back and I said, "It would be an honor to hear what I did. It would be an honor for me if you would share that with me." And she wrote back page after page after page, because she had kept journals at that time. And there were specifics, things that she found in the apartment, conversations that she'd had with him, context around conversations she'd had with him. And guys, the truth of who I had been and what I had done came tumbling in on me. The difference between being alcoholic and being a sober alcoholic is that I was not alone. I had to face the truth, but I had my best friend in early sobriety, who was also an AA, on one side of me, my sponsor on the other, and God at my back. And so I could walk through the valley of the shadow of death with others, you know, not alone. I was not alone. And I started to begin to understand what it meant what it meant to really rely on God at that point in my life. And it changed me. It was huge. Still had lots of weeds, lots of character defects, but it was a big way that God showed me himself. And kind of, you know, the story of the man who says, "If there is a God, he hasn't done anything for me." And they leave him in his hospital room. He thinks, is it possible that all the people who believe in God are wrong? And then suddenly he feels the voice of God saying, "Who are you to say that there is no God?" And then it says that he just tumbled to the floor and this great tide of power and love and grace just swept over him and changed him. That's what it feels like. That's what it felt like for me. And that's when I caught fire. You know, that's when hope was born, that I didn't have to be that person that I had been 20 years before. I didn't have to duck and hide anymore. I could face the things that I had done with my eyes open, and I could admit my wrongs without beating myself to death. Because I always felt like admitting any kind of character defect or any kind of imperfection meant that I was going to be beaten down, because I was always better than or worse than. I didn't know what it was like until I came here and started practicing these principles to be one of you. I didn't know what that was like until I came here. I'm really fortunate that I've had good home groups in my life, that I've had people who show up every week, that I've had people who could come to know me, who I could come to know. My sponsor, I have more of a relationship with her than I've ever had with anyone in my life. It's gone on longer. There's been love there. There's been faithfulness there. There's been movement through difficult times there. I was never successfully married, so I can't say that I got that from a marriage. You know, I didn't get that from friends because I dropped out. I was not a good friend. I got that first from my sponsor. And I still remember we were doing the 10th step. I've shared this in front of you before. I was still working down in West Point, down the highway from Richmond. And I would call her every day and do a 10th step with her on my way home. And I remember calling her once, it was really hard doing my 10th step. I could talk about the big, huge things that I had done when I was drinking, because those were dramatic, you know, and I had a little bit of distance from those. But to tell somebody that I've lied that day, or that I had, I think lying was a big, that I've been super selfish that day, self-absorbed, that I was upset and agitated. It was because I really wanted you to think that I was Mother Teresa, you know, especially somebody who I revered so much. So I had to tell the truth about myself every single day. And at first, it was really, really hard. And I remember one day, I just was crying on the phone with you, and I said, I'm a big fat baby. And I got home, the phones were still on the wall then. I got home and she called me and she said, I have one thing to say to you. I love you, you big fat baby. And I think that was the day she said, now change your clothes, you're gonna go speak in a meeting. And I went and spoke at the Healing Place that night with Sammy, you know? And that was I mean, I remember just the unbelievable feeling of being loved, of what that meant. I had never been able to receive, well, that's not true. I had received that. I had an older brother and a younger brother. My older brother died when I was 28. My younger brother, when I was 43, almost 43, both of them died in car accidents. And they were my best friends. I loved them so much. And neither, well, I think Chris might have been an alcoholic, but neither of them was a sober member of a 12-step program. But I knew they loved me. So I knew what that looked like and felt like. So I recognized that, you know, and I think that God put them in my life to keep me alive until Sam came along. I really do think so. I was reading the 12th step yesterday with, I've got this young sponsee. She's just got 4 months. And I was telling Sam, she's already worked the 12 steps. We've already read the first 164 pages. And why was I telling you that? Oh, shoot. My mind went, darn it. This is what it's like to be 65. My mind went, I don't know. It's been such a breath of fresh air. Sherry is a breath of fresh air too. But having somebody in my life who I can really give to, who really wants what I have to offer, is such a pleasure. You know, so often you offer your experience, strength, and hope, and the other person's not ready. And I was one of those people at one time, so I get what that's like. But I think how God must feel when we're ready, how it must feel for the God of our understanding to be received, you know, instead of pushed away, pushed back. So much. I have a lot of growing to do when it comes to my 11th step. I have been growing in that area in my life. I've really had to do something that my older brother taught me. He said, when you get confused, clear the table of everything you think you know, sorry, and go back to the one or the two things that you know that you know that you know are true and rebuild. And I have used that my entire sobriety. Because I needed to, as I mentioned before, I needed to let go of so many old ideas about God that were just figments of my own imagination and manifestations of my ego, of self. The thing that I knew that I knew that I knew was that God got me sober. I couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. I couldn't and I wouldn't. God did it for me through a series of events that I could not evade. You know, I had to face the truth about myself, and there were people there to love me and help me. So God got me sober, and God kept me sober for years of me being caught up in this performance mentality of I've got to earn my sobriety, I've got to earn God's love and approval, I've got to earn status and recognition, that my worth was based, I mean, major self-seeker here, that my worth was based in what you thought of me, so that if you thought poorly of me, I would become restless, irritable, and discontent. It's just a character defect, but one that had great roots in me. But I could go back to that and I could build from there, because if God, I mean, considering that this was a girl who dislocated her pelvis by falling down the stairs drunk, who hobbled into the classroom and taught innocent children hungover, you know, who slept with somebody else's husband. And I could I could tell you a whole lot more, right? Of the destruction that I caused in the world to all kinds of people. In the midst of that mess, in the midst of me being really awful in my behavior, God loved me enough. He loved me. In the midst of that, he saw me and he loved me. And he picked me up out of that mire and he put me in a broad place called AA. And he healed me, you know, by bits and pieces. He has healed me. And I believe that some things are quick and some things are slow for just the reason of the crops and the weeds. That if he pulled out every character defect at one time, we would die. I mean, I really believe, and I mean, I think we've talked about this before. Sometimes he uses our character defects. When I was early on with Sammy, she said, "I'm glad you're a people pleaser because that means you'll do what I tell you to do." You know, he'll use those things in ways that help us if we will just try to rely on him. Just try, you know. What did I want to tell you about that? Darn it. Oh, I had to really learn how, and this is a big, for me, it was big in AA in my growth, was learning how to set aside my old ideas. Just learning how to recognize a doubt or a prejudice, a negative belief, how to not fight with it, not try to convince myself that it wasn't true, not try to convince anybody else, but just to pick it up and set it to the side long enough to do the next right thing and to open up to a new experience. And that has made all the difference for me in peace, in inner peace, because I don't have to fight anymore. We've ceased striving. We've ceased fighting in anything or anyone. I am finally at a point at 23 years sober where I'm starting to enjoy people genuinely. I always thought of you as work. You know, I mean, I wanted you to like me and I wanted to be a good person, but man, that's hard work. And I would come home exhausted at the end of the day, whether it was AA or work or some kind of social gathering. No, thank you. You know, just work, 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 and so draining. Well, some of that is just the way that I'm made. I'm not very extroverted in that way, but a lot of it is the way that the old ideas I had about other people and about relationships and about what love was, you know? And what God is showing me, these are things, and maybe you guys can relate to this. There are things you know, right? You know them in your head early. And you can say, yeah, I know that. But you don't know them down here in your heart and your gut. You're not living by them, you know? And there's a dawning. It's deeper and deeper and deeper. It has to do with seeing myself as I really am and seeing you as you really are, right? That we walk hand in hand together. I'll tell you a funny story. I made amends to an old boyfriend that I, you know, so selfish in that relationship, but I didn't believe it. I thought that I had done some things wrong, but that he really was the greater a-hole than I was. He was a sober member of AA. And I went to make amends to him because remember, I wanted my spiritual experience. And that man sat on the other side of the booth and he said, "Meg, what exactly are you making amends for?" I couldn't tell him because I hadn't faced him. But God is good. Several years later, we were reading Joe McHugh, not sponsored. Anyway, we were reading a book on the 12 steps. And Sammy asked me to do a little mini fourth and fifth step on the sex inventory. And so I made it about him. Oh my gosh, the truth of myself in that relationship, that little tiny assignment. Whoa. And I remember she came over and I'm like, oh, I was so selfish and so inconsiderate. Do I need to make amends to him? She said, leave him alone. But that's been my experience that. What I need is the willingness. That's what the big book says. I have to have the honesty, open-mindedness, and willingness. They're crucial, essential to sobriety and to growth. If I have the willingness, God's going to do the rest of it. He's going to do the rest of it. He will help me become more honest. He will make me more open-minded, open-hearted, and he will reveal the truth. And the truth does set you free. It does set you free. Today, I can honestly say, I like you. I want to know you. I want to know what your stories are, who you are. I can listen and not have this chatter going on in my head. Sometimes it's there, that's for sure, but not as the way that I live anymore. And that's as much of a miracle to me as getting sober and staying sober is a miracle. So I think my story really is about the kindness and the patience of God and how he has been really my everything. God either is or he isn't. You know, he's either everything or he's nothing. And I choose today that he's everything. I've learned too that I can't rest on my laurels, that I have to be diligent about my 11th step, that I have to be diligent about giving away what God has so freely given to me. And I have not always done that. I have done service work in AA to be a good person in AA. I've done it to get accolades, to get my sponsor's approval. I've done it because I believed it was the right thing to do and I wanted to act the part, but my heart was not in it. I've done it with a bad attitude. I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be that person. I was reading something the other day that says that we don't perform to get God's love. We do things, we take action out of response to God's love. It's a response to God's love. And when I invite God's love in, whether it's into this room, into my heart, into our conversation, then I'm looking for him. And what does the big book say? He's there. He's there if we're willing to look, if we can search fearlessly. I don't think it's just in here. I think it's also out there. We can experience God in ways that we could never have imagined before. And that's the thing that holds us together. Our common malady gives us a common understanding that is very comforting, but it is our common solution that keeps us bound together on this journey that we trudge. And I'm just so grateful for all of you, and I thank you for listening to me.
Oh,